Good evening. I'm Kathleen Woodward. I'm director of the Simpson Center for the Humanities, and it is my distinct pleasure to welcome you all to this evening with our COTS Distinguished Lecturer, Stephen Hines. The COTS lectures constitute our highest public tribute to scholarly work in the humanities that makes a difference, that makes a difference. Each year, the executive board chooses one member of the University of Washington to receive that honor, and this year's honoree, Stephen Hines, I know, is universally admired by his colleagues here and abroad. As many of you know, Solomon Cotts was an admired, and if I may say so also, like Stephen Hines, a beloved leader at our university. Solomon Cotts was chair of the Department of History. He was the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. And among other things, he was also bestowed the award of outstanding public service. The purpose of the Cotts lecture is to honor his memory, as well as to honor work in the humanities, scholarship of the highest order, and scholarship that contributes to really sustaining our culture, our cultures, and in Stephen Hines' case, at least in the case of tonight, thinking through and into the past, through aesthetic categories, from the vantage point of the present, and so we're going to have many loops, I think, transporting us this evening. I want to thank Chelsea Yates, and I want to thank Caroline Simpson for the outstanding work they did in assembling us all together here. I want to mention that our next distinguished COTS lecturer from the University of Washington will be Thomas Lockwood from the English department. I'm very happy about that. And then finally, I want to thank the wonderful chair of our extraordinary Department of Classics, honored itself with a major award, who will introduce Stephen to us, Alan Gowing.
Thank you, Kathy. I first clapped eyes on Stephen Hines in 1986 at the annual meeting of the American Philological Association. I was a young graduate student. I was wandering around the convention in a daze when I ran into a mass of people striding purposefully down the hall. And I asked, "Where are you all going?" "A new star in Roman poetry is giving a talk," they said. "One of those wunderkinds from Cambridge. Don't miss it." You would have thought that Paul McCartney or Elvis had just entered the hotel. So I joined them, squeezing into the back of a standing room only crowd, and I heard Stephen deliver a talk on the Roman poet Ovid, the likes of which few of us had ever heard before. And I came out of that session thinking, this is a really smart guy. Little did I know that just a few years later he would become my colleague when he left the University of Michigan to join the faculty in classics at the University of Washington in 1991. He is, I am aware, well known to many of you, not only for his scholarship, but also through his many contributions to the college and the university, including a stint as chair of the Department of Classics from 1997 to 2002, and as a member of the Graduate School Council from 2007 to 10. Now, Stephen's CV is a challenge to summarize, and I'm not even going to try. A few highlights. He earned his BA and MA at Trinity College Dublin in 1979. From his native Dublin, he moved on to St. John's College, Cambridge, earning his PhD in 1985 with a dissertation that soon morphed into his first book, The Metamorphosis of Persephone, Ovid and the Self-Conscious Muse. In short order, this ensured Stephen's reputation as truly one of the rising stars in Roman poetry. Since that time, his reputation has grown apace through a rich and wide-ranging body of scholarship. But I particularly want to draw attention to the series that he founded and co-edits with Dennis Feeney at Princeton called Roman Literature and Its Contexts, and published by Cambridge University Press. In no small way, this series has transformed the study of Latin literature in all of its forms, not least through one of the series' entries, Stephen's own classic 1998 book, Allusion and Intertext, The Dynamics of Appropriation in Roman Poetry. Through this series, his own extensive editorial work, and of course through his own scholarship, Stephen has become one of the most influential voices in Roman literature of his generation, and importantly, a marvelous mentor to some of the best young scholars working in Latin poetry today. He is also no stranger at all to prestigious awards. The highlights include an NEH Fellowship for University Teachers in 94 and 95, an American Philosophical Society Sabbatical Fellowship in 2003 and 04, and since 2003, of course, he has been the Byron W. and Alice L. Lockwood Professor of the Humanities here at the University of Washington. Most recently, Stephen won another NEH Fellowship for University Teachers, which he will hold next year. The NEH will allow him to concentrate on a project that centers on one of his great interests, the reception of Latin poetry. And this book project, entitled Poetry Across Languages, will consist, I think, of a series of essays on the cross-linguistic and intercultural relations of Latin literature that ranges over an astonishing several centuries and many different texts. I think you're going to get a glimpse of this project this evening. His talk should also convince you, I hope, that Stephen is more than simply a great classicist. He is also a broadly trained humanist in the very best sense of that word, a scholar and a gentleman whom I'm honored to call colleague and friend. So please join me in welcoming Stephen Hines.
Well, thank you both very much indeed. It's a, it's a pleasure and an honor to be here. Two of my favorite UW institutions, the Cotts Lecturership and the Simpson Center for the Humanities, rolled into one evening. I'm very, very happy to be able to be part of our event this evening. Now, as Alan just implied, this evening's lecture comes from a larger project titled Poetry Across Languages. And there are two ways in which I could set this up for you. What I'm not going to do is to paraphrase the pitch which I wrote up for my grant application to the National Endowment for the Humanities a year and a half ago. Instead, I'm going to give you a more autobiographical setup. But while I'm talking, I'll leave that NEH pitch up there on the screen for a couple of minutes, just for the record. And the only other thing I'll say about all these words here is about the last sentence, which I've highlighted, which gives the first of my examples tonight of translation. This is how you say in grant applicationese, I am completely unqualified to write about this topic. Now, like most children in Dublin in the 1960s and early 1970s, I spent my school years, in particular my teens, in a school whose curriculum hadn't changed much since the 1950s, perhaps since the 1930s. I had 6 full years of Latin, and rather more unusually, I had 5 full years of ancient Greek. There was a strong incentive to take first year Greek because it gave you a waiver from both physical and religious education. Second year Greek thins the herd a little bit. To continue Greek, you had to permanently drop science at the age of 11, which even in those days seems a little irresponsible. But as it happens, my favorite subject in those
lawyer, who redeemed himself by writing a poem for the school magazine a couple of years after he won his Nobel Prize. Anyway, all that finished poetry stuck with me, and I wanted to edit it back with how much the poetry has stuck with me came through a few years ago when I was preparing my high school English experience at a conference with a New Zealand-born professor of classics who had gone from equally old-fashioned secondary school in Auckland. Around 2 a.m., after three or four margaritas, we found that between us we could still recite Milton's Lycidas end to end. And that's exactly what we did. I'm sure everyone in the hotel bar enjoyed it too. Anyway, because we never did anything in school that could be called literary criticism, I've always wanted to come back to some of the English poems that I've asked to memorize all those years ago, using the tools of my trade as a classical Latinist, and here I am. I begin not with Milton, but with his 17th century contemporary, Andrew Marvell, whose career spans the reigns of Charles I and II and the Cromwellian regnum. The Marvell poem which I read in school at age 15 was The Guardian. Suspected priests who controlled the national curriculum ruled out to his coy mistress because of the raging hormones. War of the Guardian and the Government. My own start was something written by Marvell when he was 15 years old, and already in a precocious way at the time, a student at Cambridge. As you can usually see, this poem, page 15, is in Latin. On the occasion of the anticipated birth of the fifth child, King Charles I, several students put together, as was customary, a book of celebratory verses. Marvell's contribution is a Latin piece in Sapphics, imitation of the second poem in Horace's first book of Odes. Indeed, if I set the beginning of Horace's poem alongside the beginning of Marvell's, with the 100% identical wording in red, you would need much Latin to see that Marvell has written the poem not so much in the style of Horace Odes 1-2, as in the words of Horace Odes 1-2. Hence Marvell's title, a parodia for King Charles, where parodia means not so much parody as parallel or side-by-side ode. We can see that the parodia is a supernaturally charged crisis of book in which the epiphany of the royal baby, like the epiphany of Augustus in narration ode, promises to bring succor and salvation. The Marvellian crisis closely follows the pattern of the Horatian one. The city, Cambridge, taller than Rome, is beset by an emergency. For Rome, flood, Cambridge, and outbreak of the plague, historically attested for 1636. In both cases, the crisis is represented as national and a popular. One thing to say is that the kind of political transformation envisaged in this strange poem, the rule of Charles I, imaged as the rule of Augustus, or Horace's own the rule of Augustus, was imaged as the rule of Olympian
god to be named later, is not in itself unusual in the early modern period. And indeed, in a very broad sense, it's quite untrue to say that there's no work here for the critic. The very literalism of the typology is partly what makes the parodia fascinating as an instance of lived 17th century classicism. But for a critic interested in the poetics of verbal transformation, the pickings in the lines now on the screen may seem slim. Let me use my red highlighting again. The River Tiber is updated to the Cam. The first century threat of the Persians or Parthians is updated to the 17th century threat of the Turks. Apart from that, almost 100% congruence of imitation to model. Not so much translation or transformation as mere transcription. Only by special pleading will this shadow poem yield the crackle of originality which we will look for in the mature Marvell. And yet, even in this exercise in intertextual minimalism, or should that be maximalism, there are things I could point to throughout the parodia which would reveal Marvell to be capable of using the word-for-wordness of word-for-word transcription to make his very small modifications pull their weight. Here's just one. On the third line in the screen, should we register the fact that one of the few changes which Marvel makes to Horace's wording here is to edit out a reference to civil war. Cives acquisse ferrum. In Marvel, armed citizens become armed heavens. Remember that the Parodia is written in a period of increasing confrontation between King Charles and his parliament, and 5 short years before the outbreak of full-scale civic conflict. And that perhaps gives us a license to weigh every word when the fully formed poet takes the enterprise of literal Latin to a higher level in some episodes of parallel English and Latin composition later in his career. Now, that a mid-17th century poet like Marvel should have a corpus of Latin poetry, some 20 pieces, between 5 and 10% of his known poetic output, is no surprise. Exercises in translation from Latin to English, and back again into Latin, will have been part of Marvel's own school days, and also part of his later work as a tutor. Moreover, another of Marvel's day jobs was a period of government service in the 1650s as assistant to the Secretary for Foreign Tongues in the Commonwealth of England, commonly known as the Latin Secretary, a job in which his immediate supervisor was none other than John Milton. So it's relevant to note that when Milton published the first definitive collection of his poems in 1645, it was a double book containing a vernacular volume of English poems, plus a handful in Italian, followed by a volume of Latin poemata, plus a couple in Greek, with many thematic links across the two volumes. What we can't talk about in Marvel's case is a dialogue between poetic languages at the level of the book, for the simple reason that most of Marvel's verse remains unpublished until after his death. But we can talk about instances of paired English and Latin poems in Marvel, which were clearly conceived together and meant to be read together. And sometimes, at least, when Marvel translates Latin into English and English into Latin, his exploration of issues of verbal literalism and verbal transformation seems to be a way of negotiating the things which are most Marvelian in Marvel, his movements towards the transcendental. On the screen here, I set out the opening and closing lines of On a Drop of Dew, one of Marvel's best-known poems, and of Rus, the much less well-known Latin version of the same, which stands right after it in the posthumously collected poems of 1681. All I'll say about them today is that, first, the theme of the twin poems constitutes a programmatic distillation of Marvel's interest in transcendence. Drop of dew comes down from heaven to earth, but aspires to return to heaven. And second, that the multiple word plays between English and Latin in the two poems show how an interest in transformation and transcendence can be negotiated through acts of translation. This is a textbook example of how Marvel uses Latin to think with. In the poem's opening and closing movements, from heaven to earth and from earth back to heaven, the Latin poems provide the armature and almost close the gaps between the opposing terms. Dew is to rose, as rose is to rosa. Earth is to sun, as solum is to soul. Finally, this time implicitly, the drop of dew returns to the sun as the twice repeated stilla morphs into a stella, a pun spotted, how could it not be, by Estelle Hahn, the ranking authority in Marvel's and Milton's Latin poetry. In this sense, then, the Latin poem drives the agenda of the English twin. But in a larger sense, although I'm not going to go into this here, there are moments when the English poem seems to seize the initiative from the Latin one, with pieces of conventional and classically Roman imagery in the Latin version transformed in the English version into something newer, more distinctive, and, well, more Marvelian. And this is what more systematically happens in the famous Garden and the much less famous Hortus, the poems which I put on the first two sides of your paper handout, where you can see them in their totality. But for all the things I'm going to focus on here, you'll be okay sticking with my PowerPoint. Many modern readers of Marvel don't even know that the Hortus exists. The majority of criticism of the Garden is at best perfunctory in noticing the Hortus. Good luck in finding it in a new Cambridge Companion to Marvel. Those few who do take it on tend to do so with the intensity of an embattled minority. One long debated question is about the order of composition. More commonly, the Latin poem is seen as the precursor to the English one, less commonly as a subsequent development from it. My own hunch is that the poems are designed to be simultaneous and interactive. And just to prepare you in advance, one big issue is going to be this. For stanzas 1 through 4 of the English poem, and again for the final stanza 9, the Latin poem prefigures or refigures the English one very closely. But there is no Latin to correspond to stanzas 5 through 8 of the English poem. In the posthumous edition of Marvel's verse, this big gap in the Latin poem is marked with the words desunt multa, much is missing, query. Now, coincidentally or not, stanzas 5 through 8 are where Marvel's English poem moves from the physical to the metaphysical, from the mythological to the Neoplatonic, and ultimately from the Greco-Roman to the biblical. So for Marvelian Hortus buffs, this all sharpens interest in the controversial question of whether the Latin for stanzas 5 through 8 has been lost, or whether it never existed, and whether the omission is significant or not. What I'd like to do is to look at sample bits of the two poems in parallel, taking my cues mainly from the English poem and making comparisons and contrasts with the Latin one. Then I'll consider the big gap in the Latin version. So in stanza 1, the misguided ambitions and desires of men are invoked as a foil to set up the Garden as a place of escape, repose, and contemplation. In both the English and the Latin, the opening image brings the two contrasted terms close together by setting the tired symbolism of the leafy wreaths, which marks such ephemeral distinction, the palm, the oak, or bays, against our poet's fuller commitment to the vegetative world in his garden, a place of sensory and more than sensory pleasures, a classical locus amoenus, but much more besides. And here I'm not going to talk about a pair of rival opening line puns highlighted. In the English, men lose their way in mazes. In the Latin, they lose their way in verses. On to stanza 2. English lines 9 through 12 and Latin lines 7 to 9 map closely onto one another, except that busy companies of men damps down the quasi-classical specificity of Latin lines 8 to 9, through temples, through cities, through lofty palaces. So too, in Latin, lines 17 to 18, the vocabulary of retreat from civic society continues to have a specificity absent from the English version, and this time the specificity is very clearly Roman. In 17, the circus, and then in 18, the bovine lowing of the forum, mugitus fori, which virtually names a Roman civic space, forum boarium. Now, both poems are at this point concerned with a retreat from society. But in Latin, and not in the English, interestingly, even the place to which the poet retreats from civic society sounds, well, civic. Latin, lines 14 to 15, municipem novum, frondosae cives, floria regna. What's going on here? If the Latin version precedes the English one, Marvel, as I said a moment ago, damps down the civic vocabulary in the rewrite. If the English precedes the Latin, he amps up the civic vocabulary in the rewrite. In either case, one question we can perhaps ask is whether there's an element not just of linguistic, but of cultural code switching in play here across the two versions. In Marvel's mind, is Latin language more predisposed than English to the language of civic administration and statecraft? That seems possible. Remember Marvel's service as a diplomat in the office of the Latin secretary. Is he using Latin to write a poem more Latinate in its ways of thinking than is his parallel English poem? Well, rather than pursue that further, let's move along for a quick look at stanza 4. Here we learn that Marvel's garden, and his hortus too, is a place not just of retreat from society, but of retreat from love. In this respect, Marvel is marking a major departure from the classical locus amoenus of Ovid and of the pastoral tradition, a locus which is preeminently, in etymological terms and in literary practice, a place locus of amor. This stanza, in fact, finds Marvel's garden simultaneously at its most Ovidian and at its most post-Ovidian. Famously, he evokes two myths here from the first book of the Metamorphoses, highlighted. But in doing so, he reinterprets Apollo's pursuit of Daphne and Pan's pursuit of Syrinx in a reading which replaces erotic with environmental desire. And what about the Latin version at this point? Well, I need to abbreviate here, but my argument would be that in this part of the poem at large, where the English poem is at its most classical, the parallel Latin maintains its difference through a sort of hyper-classicism in its profusion of mythic and iconographic detail. For just one example, take a look here at the second line of English stanza 4, when we have run our passion's heat, love hither makes his best retreat. In contrast to this vestigially personified love, at this point, the Latin version offers, in lines 32 to 5, a fully personified amor, whose retreat is visualized in four lines of detail with full iconographic apparatus of shed wings, unstrung bow, extinguished torches, and discarded quiver. When read alongside this much more extended Latin treatment, perhaps the English line, unremarkable in itself and with love only barely personified, nods self-referentially at its own retreat from the panoply of Ovidian mythological eroticism, a panoply which is discarded in the Latin version too, in the sense that here too amor takes a break, but which is also in a sense restored and reinforced in that Latin version, in that amor's weapons, even as they are discarded, are catalogued one by one in full Ovidian detail. In the big picture, both the English and the Latin poems enact a pledge by Marvel to transcend the love poet's traditionally instrumental use of nature for erotic ends. For all that, the Latin remains much more mired than the English one in all the trappings of traditional eroticism. So is Marvel's point that the English thought comes into its own when it loses the clutter of classicism? Or is his point that the English thought is sustained and strengthened by a hidden armature of classicism? Discuss in 4 pages or less. Now, you remember the stanzas 5 through 8 are the ones of which Marvel either never intended to do a Latin version, or never got around to doing one, or for which his Latin version got lost before the posthumous edition of his works. Before I say a bit about those, let's look at the final part of the parallel Latin and English composition in which the Latin poem apparently resumes its engagement with the English one at stanza 9. Both poems end with a meditation on time and with a description of an actual modern architectural feature in Marvel's garden, a floral sundial and zodiac, which carries a certain freight of cosmic allegory and a certain number of puns. I've room here for just one vegetative sundial pun, and it's not the famous one between two different kinds of time, though I did mark that one on the paper handout. Instead, I'll offer you English lines 67 to 8, highlighted, where from above the milder sun does through a fragrant zodiac run. Fragrant zodiac maps literally onto fragrantia signa, fragrant signs, in the Latin, line 52. But the Latin has something else to offer. Where does the English phrase fragrant zodiac come from? Well, it's clearly a piece of Morwellian translationese, formed on the basis of his parallel Latin locution, fragrantia signa. And fragrantia signa, a new locution too, but this time we can see Marvel's transformative phrase formation in action. Behind fragrantia lies a word commonly used to refer to actual constellations in classical Latin poetry, namely flagrantia, flaming, a word which would aptly describe fierce and threatening constellations like those specified in Latin line 53. That is to say, it is from Marvell's own Latinate literalism that one of his most distinctive English locutions derives. And so to English stanzas 5 through 8, where we have no corresponding Latin. De sunt multa, as our text of Marvell says. Here on the screen are some highlights from the four unparalleled stanzas. The complete text is in your paper handout. These stanzas are where Marvell's English poem moves from the physical to the metaphysical, stanzas 5 to 6, from the mythological to the Neoplatonic, stanzas 7, and ultimately from the pagan Pleasance to the biblical Garden of Eden, stanza 8. The hypothesis that the English poem deliberately takes flight here, leaving the Latin poem behind in order to move into conceptual territory, which Marvell feels to be more appropriate to his own language and muse than to the ancient one, is an intriguing one. These stanzas are, in a sense, the most distinctive part of the English poem and the most personal. Indeed, Marvell may mark them as such with a pun in the first line of stanza 5, highlighted. What wondrous life in this I lead. Wondrous, that is, marvel us. So in a sense, this section of the garden is the poet's sphragis, his poetic signature. What does it mean that he chose, if he chose, not to render this part in Latin? Well, as I've been tracking, even where the two versions are at their closest, the Latin poem sometimes shows a stronger gravitational pull than the English one towards Ovidian, Roman, and classical ways of thinking. So when Marvell's English poem proceeds in stanzas 6 through 8 to the metaphysical, the Neoplatonic, and finally the transcendentally Christian, these are perhaps directions in which Marvell's Latin poem, as we know it, would be inclined not to go. But let me, just in passing here, note the recurrent vocabulary of replication and doubling in stanzas 6 and 8, including garden doubling. Stanza 8, two paradises twere in one, highlighted. The Greek word paradisos means not just paradise, but also enclosed park, pleasure garden, or just hortus. At some level, because there are others, does this language flag the English poem as itself a double of its Latinate garden twin? Well, since it's almost time to move on to Wordsworth, let's take as read the increasing distance from the terms of the hortus in the unparalleled English stanzas 6 through 8. But what about the unparalleled stanza 5? What wondrous life in this I lead, ripe apples drop above my head, drop about my head. As Marvell communes almost erotically with this stanza's cornucopia of fruit, the profusion of apples, nectarines, peaches, and melons makes this into a supercharged locus amoenus, an extreme version of Golden Age bounty. Too extreme to be expressed also in Latin? Well, hardly. This is a topos firmly rooted in the Latinate tradition. But if you really want to find a reason why Marvell might apportion this stanza to his modern English sensibility rather than to his classicizing Latin sensibility, here is one possible and pedantic angle. If we took the query mark in that editorial De Sunt Multa as a challenge and tried to reconstruct a lost Latin version by Marvell of stanza 5, how would we render apple, nectarine, peach, and melon? Well, probably give or take a modifier or two as malum, 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 and malum. It's not unfair to say that four of the five fruits in this stanza, excepting the grapes, most obviously translate into Latin as one single undifferentiated word. So, in this first stanza in The Garden, not to have a Latin equivalent, is there perhaps a linguistic joke about a profusion of fruit so unprecedented that it is beyond the resources of the Latin language to give it expression? So, to summarize, I think that what Marvell's parallel hortus and garden poems offer are a series of micro-narratives of interaction with the classical tradition. The classical tradition is usually conceived by poets and readers alike as a grand narrative, and often an overwhelmingly grand narrative. By focusing on small moments of cross-linguistic literalism, such as these, perhaps we may find ways to tweak, tinker, and negotiate with that narrative anew. And now for something completely different. After spam, spam, ham, eggs, and spam. As I've just indicated, the so-called classical tradition, an accumulation of literary texts, habits, and expectations deriving from ancient Greece and Rome, can seem to any modern poet or reader at once enabling and oppressive. It has been so for centuries, and what I'm trying to do with these glimpses of the poet's workshop, if you like, is to get inside the heads of a number of canonical writers as they assert themselves with and against that tradition. Now, in the case of Wordsworth, we're dealing with a poet who doesn't have a bilingual oeuvre, which would be more eccentric, circa 1800, now it was circa 1650. But Wordsworth was heavily invested in the classical tradition, and as it happens, his first published sonnet, at the age of 16, was signed Axiologus, that is, Wordsworth. Now, axiologus or no axiologus, what will make Wordsworth a worthwhile case study for my project are the kinds of pressures upon him at various points in his career to interact differently with literary tradition following the classicisms of the long 18th century. There's a lot to think about here, but for today, what I want to do is to frame a few glimpses of Wordsworth within his actual history of translation from Latin. Now, what first attracted me to Wordsworth for this project are two poems on classical themes, first written in 1815 to 16, his Laodamia, which you're going to go through today, and his Dion, which we're probably just going to wave at in passing at the end. And what attracted me even more was the opportunity to engage with all the paratextual material available in this splendid multi-volume Cornell Wordsworth published a couple of decades ago, which sets alongside one another not just Wordsworth's first, second, and subsequent editions of his various poems, along with his own published notes and glosses, but also his correspondence about them, his responses to criticism, and above all, his drafts and drafts of drafts, whether in his own hand or in those of his female relatives. An addition, in short, to make a classicist green with envy. A thousand-year gap that in most cases intervenes between our authors' pens and the earliest surviving manuscripts of their poetry books tends to leave us classicists with little or no material of this paratextual kind. And one reason why I've paired these Wordsworthian case studies with my Marvellian ones is that Wordsworth's drafts and revisions, just like Marvell's parallel versions, will give us an opportunity to tell micro-narratives about poetic and readerly engagement with the classical tradition, and to read that tradition as a process rather than a product. So to anticipate my readings of Wordsworth, here we'll find a poet whose recursive drafts and republications show him always in some way restless and dissatisfied in his translations of the classics, but always productively so. What would such a poet look like if he actually tried to translate the most famous poem in Latin literature? Well, as it happens, we know. He would start translating the Aeneid, he would revise and tinker with his version, and after doing some good work, he would abandon it after 3 books, unpublished. Relatively late in his career, Wordsworth did, in fact, set himself to translate the Aeneid, aiming to be true to Virgil's patterns of sound and syntax, cadence and idea, and thus tracking Virgil's Latin in a word-for-word way, which he saw as a reclamation of the poet from Dryden and other earlier translators. I'm not going to talk about this translation today much, but I've included on the screen here for hardcore Latin buffs, I'm not going to go through this, an example of Wordsworth's philologically deft and sometimes inspired literalism as a placeholder for further exploration on some future occasion. So, sometimes inspired translations, as I say, but alas, not often enough inspired for one Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Reader from Hell. Yes, the twist to the paratextual plot of Wordsworth's Aeneid is that for the first of its 3 books, we have the intermittent marginalia of Coleridge, who would amplify Wordsworth's own anxieties about the translation, castigating him sometimes for being too free and loose, at other times for being so tied to literalism as to be prosily stiff and dull, and eventually going so far as to suggest that the whole project might betray Wordsworth's poetic legacy. And that's why we don't have Wordsworth's Aeneid, more or less. Here's a bit of it. Wordsworth's version of Virgil's lines in which Jupiter predicts the early history of Alba Longa. You don't really need to speed read, just get a vague sense of it there. And here is Coleridge's reaction to it. Shall empire hold her place equals regnabitur? Order on the mock heroic? For myself, I wonder at your patience in wading through such a stiff manes mortuum of dullness, and that of the dullest sort, to wit, history in prosing narrative prophecy, with so ludicrously anachronical a familiarity of names and detail, old acquaintances of the last Plutonic sex millennium. Okay, this isn't Auden's secondary epic. Later on, when Wordsworth is translating Virgil's account of the Epiphany to Aeneas, of his disguised mother Aeneas, Coleridge unloads again. He says, I am sick of finding fault, the more discomfortably because my main feeling is that of faulting you for undertaking what, compared with the original, is scarcely a possibility. However, just occasionally, Coleridge finds something that he likes. Here on the screen is Wordsworth's version of the Virgilian account of Aeneas' ships making landfall in a sheltered and scenically overhung bay in Carthage. Look in the atmosphere of a passage for a minute. Coleridge's note, beautiful. And incidentally, in the wonderful Cornell edition, we learned that in one of the translations that Wordsworth is using at this point, a 17th century translation, there's a small pencil caricature of Wordsworth, perhaps by Dora, in the right margin of the translation, right against these lines, Wordsworth is shown with his hand thoughtfully on his chin. So, what we have here, perhaps, is a moment of aesthetic convergence for Wordsworth, his family, and Coleridge at one particular moment in this Aeneid translation. It's a scene of a shadowy, craggily overhung body of water, Virgil and Lake District. So let me just leave that sort of thought of momentary intersection between a Virgilian and a Lake Poets project. I'm not going to pursue the Aeneid further today, but I do want to bear it in mind as I move on to talk about Wordsworth's no less meticulous and anxious and sometimes blocked adaptations of classical themes elsewhere. And this is where I'm going to track back a few years earlier in his career and take a look at the Laodamia. Now we're going to focus on the final section of Wordsworth's narrative poem about Laodamia, which is a part that I put along with some of the paratexts in my paper handout. Again, I'll take you through it on the PowerPoint. Not a strict case of poetry across languages, but one way in which translation is immediately relevant in this poem is that Wordsworth's self-awareness about his engagement with the classical versions of this myth does lead him to pepper his verse in this poem with Latinisms, which aren't on the screen here, but some Latinisms in the poem. Self-devoted, purpureo, or a construction, what time the fleet. The poem can be described, and by the way, Latinisms in Wordsworth are also often Miltonisms. The poem can be described as a kind of transcendent reading of the myth, and indeed Wordsworth pretty much signals such an aspiration in his authorial note. Says, highlighted there, I wrote with the hope of giving it a loftier tone than, so far as I know, has been given to it by any of the ancients who have treated of it. It cost me more trouble than anything of equal length I have ever written. Okay, the myth. Remember, Protesilaus is the first Greek to die at Troy, right at the point of disembarkation. And he left behind a new bride, Laodamia, and a half-built marital home. Laodamia's grief in Greek poetry, going back to Homer, in Catullus 68 in Latin, in the Virgilian underworld, in Ovid's Heroides and elsewhere, her grief was proverbially inconsolable. Now, Wordsworth follows the version in which the gods grant to the dead Protesilaus a temporary visit to the widowed Laodamia, conducted by the god Hermes. He doesn't follow the version where Laodamia conjures up a likeness of her dead husband by going to bed with a full-size wax Protesilaus love doll. In Wordsworth's loftier toned version, the visiting Protesilaus, who in life has purposefully sacrificed himself at Troy for the greater good to fulfill an oracle, has in death embraced a rather Neoplatonic vision of an afterlife in which all earthly emotions, including love and passion, are superseded. A vision of dispassionate virtue which he tries, unsuccessfully, to communicate to the living Laodamia, warning her, in the highlighted line there, against the impotence of love, by which he means not impotence, but Latin impotentia, lack of self-governance, another Latinism which Wordsworth abandons in a later edition of the poem. Now, when after 3 hours, Hermes returns to reclaim the husband, and this is where my paper handout joins the poem, the wife succumbs to her ungovernable love and falls dead in something which is close to, but not quite the same thing as an act of suicide. Presented as a moral failure, a failure of the spiritual, a failure to transcend earthly passion. So this poem is both a story of transcendence, the husband's, and a story of failed transcendence, the wife's. No transcendence for Laodamia then, but there is a kind of transformation. In the final lines of the poem, Wordsworth, taking the anecdote, as he says, from the elder Pliny, tells how a knot of spiry trees forever grew from out the tomb of him for whom she died. Now, these trees over Protesilaus's tomb don't contain the actual transformed bodies of Protesilaus and Laodamia, as they might in an Ovidian narrative, but they do seem to embody the stories, both of Protesilaus and of Laodamia, through a kind of transference. As with Marvel and his revisionary read of Daphne, we're in a natural world in which the boundaries between humans and trees are negotiable in ways which are metamorphically Ovidian and yet not quite metamorphically Ovidian. But what interests me in particular this evening are the lines just before these in which it falls to the poet editorially to pass judgment on the unhappy Laodamia. It's to this passage that Wordsworth was clearly referring when he wrote of the poem, remember, it cost me more trouble than almost anything of equal length I have ever written. Initially, in his first publication of the poem, Wordsworth pleads for leniency in the case of Laodamia. Judge her gently, who so deeply loved her, who in reason spite, yet without crime, was in a trance of passion thus removed, delivered from the galling yoke of time and these frail elements, to gather flowers of blissful quiet mid unfading bowers. But in subsequent revision, and then in successive rewrites and republications thereafter, this leniency becomes unforgiving harshness, and that initial judgment is transformed into something close to its diametrical opposite. Because here's the remarkable thing. We know that Wordsworth rewrote this stanza at least 4 or 5 times in the 30 years which followed the poem's initial publication. On the top of the screen here again are the lines as they're first published in 1815, as I just read out. On the bottom, from Ketchum's splendid Cornell edition, are the same lines as they appeared when Wordsworth published the poem in 1820, with the key changes marked. And on this screen, I've added how the first 3 of the lines were changed again in their final published rewrite in 1845. So in the first publication, Laodamia is delivered into what are clearly Virgil's Elysian fields to gather flowers of blissful quiet, etc., something which Virgil himself had conspicuously denied to Laodamia. But then Wordsworth's change of mind after the first publication radically revises his ending to deny Laodamia access to those Elysian bowers and to place her, as Virgil had, in a harsher region of the underworld among those doomed, like Dido, to a twilight of continued suffering. Now, as a modern Virgilian would be the first to point out, if this later hardening of Wordsworth's judgment against Laodamia brings him closer to the letter of the Aeneid's judgment on both Laodamia and Dido, his earlier softer stance arguably brings him closer to the spirit of the, as opposed to letter, of the Aeneid's attitude to losers and victims. And it's significant that even as Wordsworth's determination of Laodamia's underworld fate changes from the lenient to the harsh, he retains the transition line which quotes the sententia associated more than any other in the Aeneid with sympathy for the vulnerable, sunt lacrimae rerum. In a sense, then, there are competing literalisms at play in Wordsworth's construal of Virgil here, as also more broadly in his attempt to go beyond Virgil, Ovid, and all the other ancients to find a loftier truth in the myth. Now, there is one other way to look at Wordsworth's radical reversal in his treatment of Laodamia. It takes us into the extended paratext, and that involves Wordsworth's wife, Mary. Here is the diary of Wordsworth's friend and portraitist, Haydon, in 1820. Quote, Laodamia, one of Wordsworth's finest things, his wife persuaded him, had too lenient a fate for loving her husband so absurdly. At her petition, he corrected the conclusion as it was first published and made it end as above. In the poem, a husband, Protesilaus, tries to persuade his wife, Laodamia, to see their moral choices as rigorously and dispassionately as he does, in vain. In the story of the poem's composition, a wife, Mary, tries to persuade her husband, William, to see those same moral choices as rigorously and dispassionately as she does, with some success. In a sense, Mary's intervention sets up a contest in wifely devotion between Laodamia and herself, a contest which she wins. So, what's the last part of Haydon's diary entry here, now on the screen, and it's a passage brilliantly treated by John Barrell. Let's leave Wordsworth reading aloud this poem about the challenges of extreme spousal devotion, while his wife Mary, the same Mary who had fought to police that poem's extreme spousal devotion, sits by the fire, subverbally joining in his recitation in what strikes an onlooker, Haydon, as a display of extreme spousal devotion. Well, if I weren't afraid of overselling romanticism, I would say that the anecdote blurs together poetry and biography in an overwrought way, typical of the period. What I will add is that Haydon's phrase, like a distant echo, emphasized here, subliminally introduces another classical and Ovidian myth into the paratextual narrative, Narcissus and Echo, another tale of overwrought role play involving a self-absorbed male and a devoted, adoring, yet not quite self-effacing female. Life transformed into poetry, poetry transformed into life, poetry, life, and the classical tradition never quite done with their respective and mutual translations. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.